This is more work than in my previous life. I thought it would be easier.
Really? Really, Mr. President?
Yes, really.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs.
Another.
Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. In Oregon on 91.7 FM KYAQ on the Central Coast, 106.7 FM Queso in Cottage Grove. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania on 92.9 FM WLRI. In Maui, Hawaii on 88.5 FM KAKU. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN 94.1 FM. In Palenville, New York on 102.9 FM WLPP. In Grand Rapids, Michigan on WPRR. And in Minneapolis, St. Paul on AM 950. The Progressive Voice of Minnesota. We're also heard streaming coast-to-coast and around the globe on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR, Revolution 99, Detour Talk, Radio Monterey, and Radio Sputnik. Blanketing planet Earth 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you for joining us. We are now 100 days into this long national, international nightmare. We will get to that with my guest very shortly. Also coming up later on, Desi Doyen will be with us. Hi, Desi.
Hey.
How are you, Desiree?
Oh, I'm enjoying the crazy news volcano. Not really.
I was going to say enjoying is not a word I would use.
Yeah.
In any event, Desi will be with us with the latest Green News report as Florida is in trouble. They are calling out the National Guard. They have been ignoring climate change concerns for years. They're paying the price yet again, I'm afraid it seems right now. And it's going to get even worse for them, according to your report concerning some new numbers, some new estimates we have for sea level rise.
Yep.
So things are not going well there, but somehow you'll make it all okay by the end with your Green News report.
We'll try.
But first, well, it appears there will be no vote this week on the newest version of the Republicans' attempt to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. This latest attempt included an amendment to please right-wing hardliners in the U.S. House that would have allowed pre-existing conditions coverage and essential benefits coverage like hospital stays and maternity care to become optional for states. The new provision pleased the hard right Freedom Caucus in the U.S. House, but it resulted in so many so-called moderate Republicans apparently bailing on the effort that the entire thing, once again, has now failed, at least for this week. So there will be no replacement bill for Obamacare in Trump's first 100 days. Just one of many, all of them, in fact, of his major legislative initiatives that he had promised in his first 100 days during the presidential campaign that have now failed to come to pass. To paraphrase his latest dangerous saber rattling with North Korea over the past 12 hours, it is another major, major embarrassment for Donald Trump, if he is capable of that sort of thing. And just to remind you what he used to say before he became president about the job of being president and issuing executive orders when it was Obama issuing those orders. Well, here's a bit of a montage.
Signing executive orders is not the way our country was supposed to be run.
Nobody ever heard of an executive order
Then all of a sudden, Obama, because he couldn't get anybody to agree with him, he starts signing them like they're butter.
You have a president that signs executive orders because he can't get anything done.
He signs on immigration and on other things. I want to not use too many executive orders, folks. The executive orders are an outrage. We have a president that can't lead. He said, the hell with it. I'm not going to do this anymore. I want to rest and I want to do other things, including going out play golf. This guy played hundreds of rounds of golf.
Yeah, that guy did. That was, of course, Donald Trump then. Now, all he has to show, it seems, so far for his first 100 days of his presidency is a lot of panic, a lot of havoc amongst the populace, not only in the U.S., but around the world, and a whole bunch of executive orders that he'd signed. In the meantime, according to a Reuters interview published today, Donald Trump misses driving, feels as if he is in a cocoon, and is surprised at how hard his new job is. President Donald Trump, they say, on Thursday reflected on his first 100 days in office with a wistful look at his life before the White House.
I loved my previous life. I loved my previous life. I had so many things going. I actually, this is more work than in my previous life. I thought it would be easier. I thought it was more of a, I'm a details-oriented person. I think you would say that. But I do miss my old life. I like to work, so that's not a problem. But this is actually more work.
No, I wouldn't say you're a details-oriented person, Mr. President. And really, you thought that being President of the United States, the so-called leader of the free world, would be easier than being a real estate hustler? Really? More than 5 months after his victory and at the time of the interview, 2 days shy of his 100-day mark, Reuters reports the election is still on Donald Trump's mind. Midway through a discussion about Chinese President Xi Jinping, the president paused to hand out copies of what he said were the latest figures from the 2016 electoral map. Here, you can take that. That's the final map of the numbers, the Republican president said from his desk in the Oval Office, handing out maps of the United States with areas he won marked in red. It's pretty good, right? The red is obviously us, he said, and he handed out copies for each of the three Reuters reporters in the room. The news service notes, as if they didn't know who actually won the race in 2016. So now we're at the end of another panicked week on Capitol Hill as Trump has tried to somehow legitimize his first 100 days in office with a series of these executive orders and failed attempts at legislation on health care and a threadbare attempt at outlining what his administration described as the largest tax cut in the history of the United States. The saber rattling continues today with North Korea. And Trump seemed to threaten our friends in South Korea by suggesting he would unilaterally end a trade deal that we've had with them and force them to pay for a U.S. missile defense system being installed there, which the North sees as a provocation. At the same time today, Donald Trump spoke in Atlanta just an hour or so ago to the Terrorist Enabling National Rifle Association, or the NRA, at their annual convention, where he declared that an 8-year assault on Second Amendment rights had come to a crashing end with his election. He said no longer will federal agencies be coming after law-abiding gun owners. No longer will the government be trying to undermine your rights and freedoms as Americans, Trump said. Now, I didn't get to watch it, or perhaps I decided not to. I'll let you decide that. But our guest today, I believe, probably did. The great Heather Digby Parton joins us again today. She is known and beloved to many on the internet as simply Digby. She is the creator of the long-running Hullabaloo blog, a regular contributor at Salon.com, and a prestigious Sidney Hillman Prize winner for opinion and analysis journalism. And, of course, she is a longtime friend of the Bradcast, Heather Digby Parton. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Brad.
You heard some of that intro there that I tried to make sense of the chaos that we have seen within just the past few days, really. You know, okay, so we'll get into some of the broader 100 days analysis. It feels like 100 years, frankly, including your coverage, by the way, at Salon on the first 100 days in a moment. But I want to hit a couple of these things happening today. As noted, I didn't see the Trump speaking at the NRA convention, where apparently the Secret Service, you know, despite the NRA calling for, open carrying guns everywhere, apparently the Secret Service didn't allow any guns in the room for some reason with the president. But I suspect you watched. How did it go? And is there any particular reason I should be interested in what Donald Trump had to say there?
Well, it was a love fest, as you might imagine. You know, the NRA endorsed Trump very early for them. I mean, I think it was 6 months before the election. Normally, they wait until the fall before they issue their endorsement. But they were on the Trump train very early. They love this guy. I mean, and this is despite the fact that, you know, Trump is, he's sort of a citified dude, right? He's not a rural hunter type, although he always talks about his you know, psycho sadist sons who go out and kill endangered species and stuff. But, right. You know, he is a big, thoroughly endorsed politician by the NRA. And it's very interesting because, you know, one wouldn't necessarily expect that for him. But it makes sense when you think about what Wayne LaPierre did with the NRA and how he placed them in sort of the ideological spectrum of U.S. politics. And he did this going all the way back to the 1990s. He saw this populist rise long before everybody else did, and he placed the NRA right in the center of it. You know, they've always had a lot of rural followers. Mm-hmm. They've always, you know, for obvious reasons, and sportsmen and all that kind of thing. But he started probably, you know, just a little less than 20 years ago, also promoting all this other anti-immigrant stuff. He was promoting the anti-terrorist, you know, the hardcore kind of anti-Muslim rhetoric. He was promoting the idea that the Chinese were stealing, you know, Americans blind. I mean, he saw this whole side of American political life, I think, kind of fomenting earlier than most people did. And it's interesting because when Al Gore lost the race back in 2000, you know, when they did their big postmortems after that race, it was decided clearly, the Democrats said that what they had seen was the reason that Gore lost in the states. I mean, he lost his own state of Tennessee and came very close to losing in Pennsylvania, Western Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Iowa, and they lost a bunch of Democratic seats there that in that cycle because of Democratic support for gun rights. And that became kind of a gospel among the Democrats for some years. They completely abandoned any kind of gun safety or gun control. And just kind of, you know, they remember John Kerry running around with his
hunting vest
on and talking about how I eat everything I kill. You know? I mean, it's really weird. So, you know, they kind of jumped on that whole bandwagon. And that was because their analysis of their weakness in the very places that Donald Trump won this time was because of gun rights. And in fact, Trump may have actually, that is probably a contributing factor that nobody talks about in those very same areas. It's part of a sort of a tribal thing, right, which LaPierre saw early on that had to do with this idea of the lost American culture of, you know, independent gun owners and, I don't know, Confederate flag wavers and whatever else. So, I mean, that's why Trump is considered, you know, a hugely popular political figure in the NRA. They've been primed for it for 20 years.
But why? What explain? And by the way, if I don't pause for a second to note that when you talk about Al Gore losing in the year 2000, we need to put that in quotes. Losing
in the Electoral College.
Okay.
Let's put it that way.
Fair enough. in the ultimate one that was decided by the Supreme
Which
Court.
Which Trump, by the way, insists is tilted to the Democrats for some unknown reason.
yes, oddly enough, when the opposite seems to be true.
Yeah.
But it still doesn't explain why, all those things that you described are really you know, it wasn't only Donald Trump who believed all of those things. I mean, the entirety of the, you know, the Republicans who ran for president, they all kind of had the same belief when it comes to immigration, when it comes to gun rights. So I'm still having trouble figuring out what makes Donald Trump so different that in their mind, in the NRA's mind, they would endorse him as quickly and as early as they did.
Well, I think part of it has to be that, you know, LaPierre saw that, you know, that they had a real, you know, a real malleable rube on their hands, that they could absolutely, you know, they could run him. And, you know, if you have any kind of savvy about human nature at all, and, LaPierre, say what you will about him, he's a malevolent, you know, horrifying figure in American politics, but he is very smart. He's one of the smartest people around, I think. And I think he saw with Trump that, you know, this kind of flattery, putting him in front of a room full of screaming, you know, gun-toting, Republicans, that would buy a lot of loyalty from him. And there was no way that he would back off. And in fact, I think that's why, you know, he's the first president to speak to the NRA since Ronald Reagan.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's because the NRA is known as an extremist organization. And they generally a sitting president is not, you know, is not going to go and stand there in front of that particular group.
We remember when George H.W. Bush withdrew his membership in the NRA after they had described the federal government as jackbooted thugs. I wouldn't be surprised if Donald Trump used that same language today to refer to his own government, frankly.
Well, he would have, but he was too busy talking about, I did watch the speech, unfortunately, for me. He was reminiscing about his wins, as you brought up in your intro there, you know, and he handed out the map. He didn't hand out maps, but he did kind of go state by state and remind everybody about how victorious he had been. And he said, you know, wasn't November 8th the great night? Remember when they said, and he wins Michigan, and now he wins Florida. Oh, Florida. And they're all, you know, clapping, whatever. It's like, you know, I've never seen a guy relive his glory days that just happened 6 months ago quite as constantly as he does. But he did talk about that, and then he talked about how that, you know, they had to be vigilant because Pocahontas could very well be the Democratic nominee next time, and she doesn't like the NRA.
Talking about Senator Elizabeth Warren.
He didn't even call her by her real name. He just referred to her as Pocahontas, and the whole crowd erupted. And it's like, I mourn.
Well, it's, you know, it's, yeah, there's a lot of mourning going on in America. But as much fun, quote unquote fun, as it is to sort of laugh at him on things like that, more troubling today. Last night it was reported that Trump said, quote, a major conflict, that's his words, is possible between the U.S. and North Korea. He said there is a chance that we could end up having a major conflict with North Korea. Absolutely. He told Reuters in that interview, we'd love to solve things diplomatically, but it's very difficult. Today at the UN, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson reiterated that U.S. military action in North Korea is still on the table. So he is still beating the drums of war, frankly, with an unstable nuclear powered regime. And I'm talking about North Korea in this case, in case you're not clear.
I was going to ask, which one are we talking about?
But he also said, Tillerson said, that told NPR that the U.S. would be willing to negotiate directly with Pyongyang, which CNN notes is a step that other administrations have been reluctant to take, seeing that as a reward for aggressive and belligerent behavior. And that's also something that Vice President Mike Pence had apparently ruled out just 2 weeks ago. It's chaos. It seems incredibly dangerous to me. And it all happens at the same time that Anne Fifield over at Washington Post's Tokyo bureau chief noted last night that on Korean Twitter, things were blowing up because of Trump's assertion that he's going to force Seoul, South Korea, to pay $1 billion for the missile system that the U.S. is now deploying there. This all seems like a tinderbox to me, Heather. I mean, not just with our adversaries, but with our allies as well. who must be at least as confused as I am, no?
You think? I mean, I honestly, this was an amazing one because, you know, this is really playing with fire. It's one thing for Trump to, you know, be chit-chatting about, mm-hmm. you know, Mexican street gangs and you know, gun rights and mm-hmm. all the rest of his sort of domestic agenda. But this, he has to know by now how dangerous this is. They must have told him, and he doesn't hear it, or I don't know what's wrong with him. There's something wrong with him. Nobody normal would just go off half-cocked like this, talking to the press, knowing full well that this was all going to be reported out, and just kind of riffing in this way at a time when it's clear that North Korea is, you know, I mean, they are on tenterhooks about what's going to happen. There's no strategy here. I mean, you don't believe there's a strategy, do you? I don't see one. I mean, even the madman theory required that the madman not be a madman. So,
yes. Well, you know. The theory seems to be a play tough. I mean, it seems to be similar to his domestic theory, which is to, you know, pretend to be a tough guy. But then when it comes down to it, at the end, he sort of pulls his punches.
I just wanted to jump in very quick.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, because I think if you look at this from the perspective of he is a reality TV game show host, and most of his years in front of the television have been trying to project a certain image and project a certain brand. It's all basically marketing. He's trying to play to his base. I think he's trying to make his base see, hey, look, I'm doing a whole show for them. And he's never had to have any consequences, really, for any of his speech. So when you have no consequences for your speech ever in your life, it would not be surprising that you can tell someone, hey, this is really dangerous fire that you're playing with. He's never had any consequences before, so why would he care now?
That makes sense when you're talking about our adversaries, maybe. But when we're talking about our friends, you know, there was in response to that tweet I mentioned from Ann Fifield, somebody mm-hmm. said, well, this would be a great reality show if it wasn't, you know, reality.
right.
Another response was that Trump seems constitutionally incapable of understanding why we do what we do. He thinks South Korea is mooching off our goodwill. He probably thought the same thing about NATO. I mean, a case can be made for pretending to be a tough guy against your adversaries. But Heather, this week he has was promised to cancel NAFTA with Canada and Mexico, but has now said he'll renegotiate instead. He has in that Reuters interview, he has said Saudi Arabia has treated us unfairly. Apparently, South Korea is treating us unfairly. He seems like he's taken this right wing victim culture in his Fox News victim culture and has now applied it to the entire world in his foreign policy. The entire world is treating the poor United States of America unfairly.
Well, I that's a good way of putting it. And the truth is that he's been thinking this for a very long time. I mean, this is how he sees the United States as being besieged by foreigners. I mean, he is the single most xenophobic president, leader that we've ever had. I mean, the United States has we've always had issues with immigrants. My God, we were slave owners. We were genocidal maniacs toward the Native Americans. I mean, you know, it goes on and on. But there was this other side of it in which everybody, you know, all the Europeans who came here and people who migrated up from the South were all immigrants, basically. So, you know, they were foreigners at one point, and mm-hmm. and there have always been lots of foreigners, and we've always had trade with foreigners, and it's been, you know, a very big part of American culture. This guy he is 100% xenophobic. I mean, look, he started a trade war with Canada this week.
Yes.
You know, I mean, Canada, and then he said this, you know, I mean, on the trail, he said over and over, I mean, this thing with South Korea, the specifics of having to pay the $1 billion for the missile defense system, that I had not specifically heard before, but he certainly talked about how South Korea was going to have to step it up and
yep.
pay their fair share. He said the same thing about Japan. you know, he said it about NATO, of course, and then he backs off and says, well, they're not obsolete anymore, and they're going to, you know, they're going to pay or whatever. But he's back and forth on this. But his essential attitude toward the rest of the world is that we don't get no respect. It's this Rodney Dangerfield thing,
yeah.
You know, that nobody respects us. We're the best. We're the biggest. It's one of the reasons why I was so skeptical of this idea that he was this big isolationist. That was never what he was. What he is, I mean, he is basically an American imperialist. I mean, he believes that America runs the world. We have all the cards. We are the people who everyone should pay deference to, just the way that people think. He thinks people should pay deference to him personally. It's, you know, he is l'état, c'est moi, right? I mean, he is the state. And I think that is, you know, he is resentful of our allies probably more than our adversaries, because they tend to think that they have some right to, you know, have a say in the way things are going and what's going to happen. And he believes, and of course he's all very much about money. So he believes that everyone in the world should pay for the privilege of being associated with the United States and having alliances with the United States, and he's going to hold them up for more money. I mean, it's really simple-minded view of how the world works, and we're seeing it played out here. And, of course, he says something like this about South Korea last night. I was on Twitter, too, and I saw the very tweet that you're talking about. And I'm going, oh, my God, imagine if you're a person living in Seoul right now. In South Korea,
yeah.
And you see this, and you've got to, you know, I mean, look, Kim Jong-un is kind of a maniac. I mean, mm-hmm. This guy, I mean, now that we have one of our own, I'm going to be a little more charitable than I used to be about him.
Right.
But, you know, I can see how it can happen. And you know, you don't provoke some guy like this. You know, there are millions of people living in South Korea. Not to mention there's over, 30,000 American troops there. There's people
about
from all over the world. I mean, my God.
A quarter of a million Americans in the area. Yeah. And as, I mean, I got to tell you, you know, I'm concerned being on the West Coast here, being in L.A., you know, that we can be reached by those intercontinental ballistic missiles if that program moves forward. I can only imagine how the people in South Korea feel about it. And, this provocation is disturbing, and I think you put it well, you frame it well, Heather, that as imperialistic as we already are in the U.S. With the rest of the world, apparently that is not enough for Donald Trump, for this president, which is a remarkable thought in and of itself. I got to take a quick break here. We'll come back with more Heather Digby Parton. We'll look at a slightly broader picture for the first 100 days of the president. I'll tell you, there has been so much winning. I am sick of it already.
Stop the winning.
We'll take a quick break. We'll be back with more on the broadcast with Heather and Desi and myself. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't go away. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. So much winning from our President Donald Trump these days that I for one, am exhausted by it. Speaking with Heather Digby Parton of Salon.com, who we always like to check in with, particularly on these landmarks concerning Donald Trump. We were Heather was with us the day June 16, 2015, when Donald Trump came down that escalator to announce his candidacy for the presidency. Everyone else said, this is crazy, it'll never work, he's not serious. And at the time, Heather and I were quite concerned that he was quite serious and would, in fact, do quite well. Turned out Heather and I were a little bit more right than we, I think, each wish we had been that day and ever since. Heather, you of course, as I said, predicted much of the mess that we have seen. But looking at this first 100 days milestone, this, well, Trump calls it a barrier for some reason, an artificial barrier, but it's a milestone, a benchmark, a landmark. What has surprised you most about the first 100 days of Donald Trump's presidency?
Huh, that's a good question. You're welcome. I think what surprised me was the level of ineptitude. And not because I thought Donald Trump was a great businessman or a great leader or anything. I just sort of thought the institutions somehow were a little bit more, they were just a little bit stronger and would be able to kind of come together. I mean, whether it was the Republican Party or just the general institutions of the government. I mean, and some of them are functional. I mean, Social Security checks are going out.
Mm-hmm.
We all filed our taxes. I mean, their things are still functioning. But just it surprised me just how chaotic it is, how completely out of control the White House is. Now, having said that, let's just, there are a couple of things that are working quite efficiently, and it's very disturbing. The Department of Justice under Jeff Sessions is a truly malevolent force. They are doing everything that Donald Trump promised to do and more. The Department of Homeland Security is shaping up to be just as bad. In fact, I just heard that they're thinking of appointing Sheriff David Clark. I believe he's from Milwaukee.
Milwaukee sheriff.
And he, people die in his jail of dehydration. And he is a complete and utter, right-wing nut. And they're thinking of putting him into a high position in the Department of Homeland Security. That area, the authoritarian police state area of the Trump administration, it's working. And they put people in charge of it that know how to make it work. Mm. And that is very, very scary. And I suspect that the military is also working pretty efficiently. The problem is that he has completely shuffled off all responsibility and authority onto the generals. And I guess we should be glad about that, since the alternative would be that he'd be the one making the decisions. Nonetheless, for anybody who cares about the separation of powers and cares about, not having, members of the military, not having 7 days in May happen, concerned about this particular form of efficiency happening. But everything else is a complete mess, and it's even messier than I anticipated, and I knew it was going to be bad.
And that's, to me, has been one of the main, just how bad it is as far as, just as a businessman, as the so-called great negotiator. Let me play this clip here. He, however, disagrees. He thinks things are going well. You note in your coverage, Heather, at Salon, your coverage of the 100 days landmark, that at the same point in Barack Obama's tenure, 65% of Americans polled said they approved of the job that Barack Obama was doing. Only 29% disapproved. By comparison, you note that according to the latest Gallup polling, Trump has the worst average approval rating. So that's not just the latest Gallup polling. That's actually averaging his approval rating since he took office in January. The worst average approval rating, 41%. Of any president in that survey's history, and by a long shot, by a margin of 14 points. He is below all of the other presidents, going back to FDR, I believe. Trump, however, says it has been the most successful first 100 days in history. He told Fox News recently.
We freed up so much, and we're getting great, great credit for it. We have done so much for so many people. I don't think that there is a presidential period of time in the first 100 days where anyone's done nearly what we've been able to do.
So, Heather, a two-part question here. Is he, you and I can look at this, we can see all the things he has not accomplished. He hasn't, done any of his legislative agenda. Is he failing? His supporters still think, apparently, that he's terrific. They are still very much with him, despite his historical lows in the polls among America as a whole. So is he actually failing? And if he is failing, does he know he's failing? or is that a bunch of bluster that he gives? Or does he actually think, has his years of Fox News branded denialism led him to convince himself otherwise that he's doing really well here?
The first part of your question, is he failing? Yes. I think he's failing on as a just as a general sort of observation of what a president should be able to do, which is consolidate his power, put together a White House staff, his government, take control of his party. I mean, he's got a full, you know, I mean, this guy has the Congress, too. I mean, it's not like he's out there alone with a Democratic Congress blocking him mm-hmm. at every turn. He can't get anything done at all with anybody. So, I mean, that is a major failure. And I think that I see no evidence that he's learning on the job, despite the media's insistence every 5 minutes that some mild adjustment he makes is a big pivot and he's learning and, you know, he's really starting to catch on or whatever. I see no evidence of it. And last night's the interviews that he did for the 100 days show that. He has not learned anything so far, nothing. Now, whether or not he believes that he's actually succeeding,
mm-hmm.
I honestly don't know, but it kind of scares me a little bit that he doesn't know that he's failing. I am kind of hopeful that this is this is his salesman shtick, that mm-hmm. he figures that when you're losing, the best thing to do is to pretend and say you're winning. And that's how he keeps his, you know, roughly 40% of the public, and by the way, a vast number of Republicans. It's just astonishing to me how many Republicans are sticking with him. I mean, a lot of these, you know, not everybody in the Republican Party that voted for him are, you know, these NRA members, right?
Right.
I mean, there's a whole bunch of them who aren't, and they're sticking with this guy, and you know they know. You know they know what they're seeing is complete lunacy, and they're still sticking with him. So, you know, I don't know whether or not he thinks that that he actually is succeeding, or that he isn't failing, or whether or not it's just his, you know, it's his way of trying to create the conditions for him to actually turn that around. I don't know, but I do know that it makes me feel crazy to hear him say that stuff.
Well,
I mean, don't you feel like I'm in an alternate universe here? I mean, how can the president of the United States be saying this utter nonsense?
Because he thinks he's pulling off a Jedi mind trick.
Well,
if he says it, you know, we are success. I mean, that's what he does. That's how he plays. It doesn't matter what the facts are. It's what, you know, the reality, and this is, listen, he's the Fox News president. This is what they do on Fox News. They say what they believe or what they want to be true, whether it's true or not, and it becomes true and it works. And as far as, you know, among their supporters, Josh Marshall over at Talking Points Memo points out this week that Trump appears to have no actual agenda, no actual ideological agenda other than winning. In other words, if Paul Ryan, he said, came forward with a plan to repeal and replace Obamacare with a single-payer health care plan, Trump would likely favor that. He would be all in support of that, even, you know, at the same way right now he supports this other, the Republicans' version of what were they on, 2.0 or 3.0 of Trump care now, that would take away health care from millions. Trump supports that, and he'd support single payer because what he cares about is winning. He doesn't actually care about what he wins at all. Is Josh right about that?
I think so. I mean, I I've thought that for a long time. I don't think he actually cares about anything. And to the extent that he did, it was just a couple of things. One is this respect for America. I think that's at least been something that he's consistently said over the course of many years. So I have to assume it's something that, you know, is embedded in his brain somewhere. Whether you call that a belief, I don't know. And he used to, you know, his beliefs about trade, I thought, might even have some, you know, level of seriousness about them. Turns out that's not true at all. He has no clue. This NAFTA thing mm-hmm. that happened just in the last couple of days, where he was ready to abruptly withdraw, and then Wilbur Ross, his Commerce Secretary, and Sonny Perdue, Secretary of Agriculture, came in with that colorful map you mentioned,
mm-hmm.
and where it showed him how his voters would be affected if he just abruptly withdrew from NAFTA, and it would be people in red states, you know, with farms who export to Mexico and Canada. And suddenly he went, oh, the farmers like me. Well, I like them too. I mean, this is like a quote. that the farmers like me, I like them too, and I want to help them. And so he decided not to withdraw from NAFTA. And they made up some story about how he talked to he actually did talk to them,
yeah.
But he made it sound as though they had come to an agreement that he would hold off on the withdrawal. But the truth is that Wilbur Ross and Sonny Perdue showed him that some farmers, you know, some of his voters mm-hmm. would be affected. Now, I had assumed that Trump had some knowledge of trade deals because he's been talking about this for a very long time. I gave him way too much credit. So, you know, I don't think he believes anything, and I don't think he knows anything. It's what Desi said. This is a performance to him. He's performing the role of president, and he thought that's what the president did.
And one of the characters he's played is the role of the great negotiator. But now,
oh my God,
everyone is seeing he's a terrible negotiator. He backs off of everything. He backed off of the promise over NAFTA. He, you know, promised there was going to be a vote on health care, and then that went away. He collapsed on that. He collapsed on China. So I'd argue, in addition to being lousy at presidenting, he's also terrible at negotiating.
I don't think there's any doubt. And I think that, I mean, he has always, you know, like when he would talk about military strategy, the only tactic he ever endorsed is a surprise attack. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. If you're not a kamikaze, you know, you don't know anything about military strategy. It's the same thing with negotiation. He has only one strategy. It's to walk in, make a completely ridiculous demand, and if they don't immediately capitulate to that and go, oh, gee, we're so scared, you know, whatever you want, then he backs off. That's his negotiating strategy.
He's a bluffer. And yeah. if you're playing poker and you know someone bluffs all the time, the bluffing doesn't really
play
work
the odds.
Anymore.
Yeah, yeah, play the odds. You know, it's
very quickly, Heather, got just a couple of quick minutes here. I want to run through very quickly the response to the 100 days from the media, from the resistance, from the Democrats. Very quickly. How well have the media stepped up to the challenge of covering this president?
Well, let's just put it this way. They have talked to every single Trump voter in the United States and asked them how they feel.
Uh-huh.
And to me, that's about it. That's the only thing they've done. You know, they've gone out, you know, on these anthropological forays into, you know, eastern Ohio and asked some people sitting around at a diner what they think about Trump. And that's been their... That's been the way that they decided to cover all this. And so, you know, at some point, maybe someone will ask someone else in America what they think.
They have been, I had felt they were doing actually a pretty decent job in some respect in calling him out on his lies and actually using the L word, you know, in a headline at the New York Times, fact checking and so forth, better than I've seen in years, until we got to Syria. And yep. even North Korea and, you know, the military adventurism, which they seem to be all on board with. They haven't asked any questions. We launched a war against Syria without congressional authorization, without actually waiting until the evidence was in to determine, you know, who was behind the chemical attack. And neither the Democrats or the Republicans in Congress, much less the media, seem to be challenging any of that. So that worries me. For the future.
Oh, of course. I mean, this is how this happens, right? I mean, we watched it happen with George W. Bush. I mean, they certainly never challenged George W. Bush mm-hmm. in the beginning of his term the way they did Trump.
Right.
You know, but the minute 9/11 happened and the minute he, you know, started his march toward war with Iraq, there was never even a moment, really. Well, we've mm-hmm. been over this ground many times. Of challenging anything that they said with any, you know, with any kind of energy or you know, with an eye toward accountability. And I totally see that happening again. If Trump does decide or somehow or another backs into a war, I think that all of this difficult, you know, press that he's been getting, I think that will all fall away. I mean, they gave themselves away with the Syria airstrikes. You know, he became president tonight. Yeah.
Right. Well, right. And ever since, I mean, yeah. I had hoped for more from this particular media, which did seem to be, you know, somewhat more skeptical of Trump than they were of George W. Bush. But yeah, as soon as those rockets started flying, all bets were off, and they were back to the same old media. Democrats, how are they doing in congressional Democrats here? How are they doing in holding up the opposition to Donald Trump as you see it?
You know, so far I have been very surprised. I am seeing that, I mean, you could see there were openings there with the Trump Care Zombie, that it would be possible that maybe they could come across with some kind of offers to maybe help him out, and they decided not to do that. They've been, you know, showing a solid opposition and leaving the Republicans to have to fight it out among themselves, which is what should happen. They won this election. They have the whole thing. Now you guys figure it out. So I'm hopeful that they will continue to hold the line as this develops. I mean, what we're seeing is that this is a Republican show all the way. This is the Donald Trump Republican hour, let that happen. Let the Democrats, you know, hang back and try and reassemble their own their own coalition and pull themselves together and let Trump do his thing here.
Which I
think that's the only way.
Which I had actually wanted, we're out of time here. I have to get to the Green News Report. I had actually wanted to ask you about how the Democrats were doing as far as politically pulling themselves together. We're going to have to hold that for another day, unfortunately. Let me just leave you with this last question. Heather Digby Barton, the resistance, the people. We've got another big protest this weekend for climate science. We had a science march last week. Big numbers still turning out to all of these protests, to all of these town hall meetings. I think the people are stepping up and doing a great job. But can the resistance keep up this pace without getting burnt out? Can you? Can I?
Well, I don't know about you and I, Brad, because I'm afraid for us. I really am. I know I'm afraid for myself.
Yep.
But I do have high hopes for the people. I mean, it really does. All the reports that we hear, and not enough, by the way. I mean, we hear from every Trump voter, but the mainstream media doesn't seem interested in the fact that all over the country you've got meetings happening night after night after night with people in places that never got together before and they're becoming politically active, they're putting together actions in their own local and state and working on national politics as well. I am very hopeful about that. I really, really think, you know, if Donald Trump did one thing good for this country, he woke some people up. And, you know, hopefully we can organize enough to stop him before he destroys us all.
Stay woke, people. Don't count on Digby or I to say we're all in this mess together. Hey, Heather, I got to get out. Always great talking to you. We will do it again soon, no doubt. Heather Digby Parton, find her work at salon.com and digbysblog.blogspot.com. And, of course, on the Twitters at Digby56. Thanks, Heather.
Thanks, Brad. Thanks, Desi.
All right, a quick break, and we're back with the Green News Report.
You know what? I just want to jump in really quick.
Yeah.
You know how Heather had said that the Trump administration, the Department of Justice, and the Department of Homeland Security have been very successful in carrying out their malevolent policies. And we're lucky that the Trump administration is as incompetent as they are. But one thing that they have been very, very good at and successful at, I think, is rolling back environmental protections.
I would say they have been successful in trying to, as they have been successful in trying to do that same thing at the DOJ. They've been stopped by the courts. There's been a lot of challenges. So they have only been so successful. They have certainly tried at both the EPA and the DOJ. And I think at the DOJ, they're able to get away with a little bit more because there's more secrecy there with the, you know, customs and Border Patrol and so forth.
You make a good point that it ain't over yet.
The resistance is holding for now. Quick break, and we're back with Green News Report and more on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't go away. I wish we could stop the world.
Stop the world, I want to get off.
Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. As we went to the break, some of the news many of us fear, breaking news that apparently North Korea has now fired a missile. Very few details now, just now coming in. CNN says North Korea has launched a missile that landed in the Sea of Japan, also known as the East Sea, according to U.S. official. It was probably a medium-range ballistic missile fired from the Pukchong airfield and flew for about 30 to 40 kilometers before landing in the waters off the Korean peninsula, according to the official. So far, that is all we know. I guess now we will find out how and if Donald Trump responds, or if he is the paper tiger that we were discussing there with Heather Digby Parton. But in the meantime, I guess let's get to it. Cheer us up, Desi Doyen, with our latest Green News Report.
Today we are putting the states back in charge. It's a big thing.
Trump moves to review and maybe revoke national monuments.
Sky-high flames forcing thousands from their homes.
Florida calls out National Guard to fight drought-fueled wildfires. Even oil companies predict a surge in electric cars. People's Climate March to demand climate action. Plus, sea level rise estimates doubled thanks to the melting Arctic.
Thanks, melting Arctic. All of those stories and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Today I'm signing a new executive order to end another egregious abuse of federal power.
You're signing an executive order to fire yourself? Cool. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, Republicans in the state of Florida have been denying climate change and global warming for years. And well, once again, it looks like they're paying the price for that.
Yes, unfortunately, it does look like that.
My driveway leading to my house looks like another planet.
This used to be a home.
Florida's wildfires are still raging out of control.
These fires are dangerous. They're extremely dangerous. We have to be very cautious.
Florida Governor Rick Scott has called out the state's National Guard to help fight the more than 100 out-of-control wildfires that have destroyed dozens of homes and forced the evacuation of thousands in tinderbox conditions caused by high winds and drought. And it's not just in Florida. Wildfire season in the United States is already 400% above normal for this time of year.
So for Florida, the water is rising up. And the trees are burning down.
That's right. President Trump accelerated his assault on the environment and public lands on Wednesday, ordering a review of all national parks and monuments created by previous presidents since 1996.
Today I'm signing a new executive order to end another egregious abuse of federal power and to give that power back to the states and to the people where it belongs.
Although couched as a local control issue, critics charge the administration's real goal is to strip valuable public lands of protected national monument status, to open them up to industry for drilling, mining, logging, and potentially to be sold off. No president in U.S. history has ever revoked a previous president's national monument protections created under the Antiquities Act. Nothing in the law allows for it, but the Trump administration is going to try. The move was slammed by the Outdoor Industry Association, which said their industry generates nearly $900 billion in local economic activity and tourism and creates more than 7 million jobs in the U.S., far more than the fossil fuel industry.
I love this comment from his signing ceremony.
The previous administration used a 100-year-old law known as the Antiquities Act. Have you heard about that?
Yes, yes, we've heard about it. It's a 100-year-old law. It doesn't make it any less valid.
Trump will also sign another executive order to reopen pristine protected waters in the Arctic and the Atlantic Oceans to offshore drilling, which had been protected by President Obama under directives that banned drilling until 2022 in some areas and permanently in others. Environmental groups and Native American tribes say they will sue to challenge the stripping of protections from public lands, monuments, and and those pristine ocean areas. Meanwhile, a new study projects that global sea level rise may unfold twice as fast as previously predicted due to global warming.
Great.
The new faster estimate comes from the Arctic Monitoring Assessment Program and is based on new data showing the rate of ice melt is accelerating in the Arctic and in Greenland, projecting a minimum of 2 feet and a worst case scenario of 8 feet of sea level rise by 2100. That's double the rate predicted just a few years ago by the United Nations.
This is all going really well. Perhaps I should say going swimmingly.
The study authors also say the Arctic is now locked in to dramatic changes through 2050. But they also say what happens after that depends largely on the choices we make today. Sea level rise will also force millions around the world to relocate, including here in the United States. Another study out this week warns that the central United States will see an influx of climate refugees as people retreat from rising seas on the coast. But some good news. Even oil companies are now predicting a surge in electric cars. This week, Total SA, one of the world's largest oil companies, projected that electric vehicles will make up a third of all new vehicles by 2030, thanks to the declining cost of batteries that make them increasingly competitive with conventional gasoline cars. Finally, the People's Climate March is on Saturday, April 29th, around the U.S. and around the world to demand action on climate change and to advance the goals of the People's Climate March. Democratic Senator Jeff Merkley of Oregon and Independent Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont on Thursday introduced new legislation in the Senate to put the U.S. on a path to 100% clean, renewable energy by 2050.
So much marching, so little time before it's too late. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Well, lift your head. It ain't over yet. It ain't over yet. So move. Keep walking. Soldier, keep moving on. Move. Keep walking. Until
yes,
the morning.
Please do. A little bit more information here, Desiree, from New York Times now about that North Korean missile. That is, New York Times is describing it as having sputtered as it took off. And the official who they cite here says that they did not identify what type of missile it was, but said that the test has ended in failure, as they described it. The second failure in a week or two, I think, for such a missile. So we don't know much. We will find out if, in fact, we are headed towards, as Trump described, a major, major confrontation with North Korea and our allies in South Korea, Japan, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Americans in the area. I guess we will see how Donald Trump responds at this point.
Yep.
In the meantime, we will all keep going. We will all hang in there. As I say, the resistance will keep marching ahead. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to my guest today, Heather Digby Parton of Salon, and to you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. You can download our shows anytime for free at bradblog.com. My thanks to those of you who stopped by bradblog.com/donate to help us continue what we do here on the Bradcast. You can drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the Facebooks and the Twitters, I am simply the Brad Blog. Until we meet again, which now I hope is soon, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.